Listen to some phrases. I'm so hungry, I could
eat a horse.
I walked 1,000,000 miles to get here. She could hear a pin drop. At 1,000 paces, I went for 1 mile away. He's as skinny as a rake. I've got toothpick. I'll die if I don't get that job. My history teacher was born before the Romans. What are they all examples of?
Exaggeration.
Hyperbole. Hyperbole is where you say something in an exaggerated way to emphasise a point. Anybody got a famous example of this? A hyperbole that they use?
Then I've told you that 1,000 times
before. Ah, there we go. In our reading, I could find at least 2 possible examples of hyperbole. Who would like to find one of them for me? We read Mark 13 from 1 to 23. Who could give me an example of an exaggerated phrase that might be in there? Sorry?
Not one stone will be left on
another. That could be an example, couldn't it? Not one stone here will be left on another. He could mean it literally. But equally, it could just be exaggerated. If a building is knocked down, normally you expect there to be stones. If he says, not one stone, well, left on another, it might be hyperbole. Any other examples in the passage? All men will hate you. Everybody will hate you. Actually, often in the Gospels, other parts of the New Testament, if you find the word all, it can mean every sort, rather than every single one. So it might not be an example of hyperbole. It might just be all being used in the sense of every sort of man, all over the place. Another one. You've got to get to the one that I want. Time's ticking, last chance, so I'm going to tell you.
Days of distress unequal.
Yes, Ferris wins the Mars bar.
Thank you.
I don't have any Mars bars with me. Those will be days of distress unequalled from the beginning when God created the world until now and never to be equalled again. Says Jesus of the disaster he's describing. We're going to come to the disaster in a moment, but he says in that verse, it'll be so bad, the world has never seen the equal in the past, and it will never see the equal again. And it seems like exaggeration, doesn't it? In fact, you can find similar phrases elsewhere in the Bible used of other devastating incidents. But is there a chance that maybe Jesus means it literally? Come back to that. Okay, let's start now with our key issue for this sermon. The Bible says God is love. So surely there should be actually no disasters, surely? Yes, if he's love, then why should there be any disasters? And yet, suffering is all around. Human beings suffer through purposeful evil. In other words, where human beings on purpose hurt other human beings. War is the great example between nations, within a country, an oppressive government that harms its own citizens, personal crime, an attack by somebody you meet, or somebody you know, sadly even. Horrible things are done by human beings to human beings. But on top of that suffering, we suffer through the side effects of people's misbehaviour. So now they're not directly attacking us, but things they're doing affect us badly. The greed of one nation may leave another nation in starvation. They don't maybe intend it, but it's the effect of their choices. How else do human beings suffer? I've given you two. I've given you purposeful, and I've given you accidental side effect of people's misbehaviour. What else triggers human suffering? So unfair. David's just like, make us really work this evening.
Collapse of a banking system. Disease.
Okay, so we'll take those two as acts of God in the insurance terms. Where you get a system where something falls apart and stops working properly, an accident, or a flood, or a famine, or a disease. In the case of that, it's slightly different. We'll come back to Pharisees maybe in a moment. Stay with Brian's for a moment. We're not causing it directly. Something comes upon us and we suffer. It's the system that we're in. I mean, we might cause it indirectly, of course. We may have caused the famine or the flood in some way by being stupid, but maybe we didn't. It just came upon us. And then to go back to Pharisees' one, happens through human beings getting stuff wrong. Human beings not being malicious, but being ignorant, being negligent, making mistakes, medical errors, bad cooking problems, economic issues, whatever it may be. All of these ways, four different ways I've listed, human beings, we suffer. We get hurt. We get caused problems, stress, strain, pain. These problems affect us individually. They hurt us in ourselves, but they affect us as groups. And so the result is that lives suffer personally, but lives suffer together. Cultures get damaged, societies get broken, nations collapse, patterns of life that maybe have gone on for decades, if not centuries, ruined, fine works of human ingenuity lost, human invention, human art vanish when a disaster comes. And of course, that's just all of our suffering. Then there's just the problems with the world, that the world suffers as a result of all of this. Animal life being lost. Natural beauty, places being damaged, smashed, broken, killed. If a God of love is in control of the universe, surely he would prevent all of this and let it go on happily. Well, I want to talk about that question using Mark 13. It's a passage which, as you heard, centres on catastrophe. A catastrophe that engulfed the land of ancient Israel 2,000 years ago. I want to see how Jesus talks about it and how it can help us to think about God and to think about human suffering. So I'm going to use three parts to do that. I'll talk firstly about the disaster that's in this chapter. Secondly, I'll go back to that question. Why does Jesus call it the worst disaster of all time, past, present and future? How are we meant to take it? And thirdly, let's talk about how Jesus can make a positive statement right in the middle of a depressing description of abject human misery. The Mark 13 disaster. In the chapter, Jesus is preparing his apostles, his disciples, his team, and indeed through them, all the first century Jewish Christians, for the devastating ruin of their capital city, Jerusalem. In the late 60s AD, you had the Jewish War. In the Jewish War, groups within the Jewish nation battled against their Roman overlords. They would throw off the yoke of foreign empire. But they also battled against one another and fought with one another to do this. People wanted control. The Romans won. It was a crushing victory. Won in 70 AD, though there were further victories to follow. And Jerusalem was ruined. Anybody know the name of the general who defeated Jerusalem?
Vespasian.
It was Vespasian at the start, but he got called back to Rome to become Caesar. Do you know who replaced him?
What, as the general?
Yeah, as the general. His son?
Oh, right.
Not Hadrian, later in time.
Titus,
indeed, who would later be Caesar. Titus took control and was there as the general when the victory came. He oversaw a siege. It was a horrible siege. Starvation spread through the city. There are even stories in the historian of the time of cannibalism, a mother eating her own child. Many were slaughtered by the Roman army as well, once they got through the walls, and the city was flattened. The temple at the heart of Judaism was obliterated, smashed to pieces. If you know about the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, the remains of those days where people go and remember with sadness what happened, it's not part of the temple as far as I understand it. It's actually something from lower down. As Jesus said, everything was smashed. Roman success was won with cruelty and it was won with destruction. Sadly, some of the behaviour of the Jewish groups inside the city was also horrible. Ugly, cruel, vicious, altogether terrible. Jesus here predicts it 40 years before it happens. He could see. He could see what was coming. And he described it to warn his people. He told his people how to survive the run-up to it, because he said, life's going to get very difficult for you. And then he told them how to escape the final siege. And for that, he gives them a sign in verse 14 to look out for. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong. He's describing a very ugly event that would occur in the temple. He's using the language of the prophet Daniel that people would be familiar with and that they'd previously seen come true with a previous emperor. And without going into all the details, Jesus says, watch the temple. And when something happens that just degrades it and blasphemes it and offends, run. Fast. And leave your old life behind. Because the disaster is near. And Jesus then goes on to warn. He says, and when I say run, I don't mean, well, make some plans and, you know, maybe move out of the city in 3 months once you've sold your house. I mean, run that day. I mean, leave right now. And you better pray, he says, because vulnerable people amongst you are going to be under threat. You're going to have to protect them. And you're going to pray that it won't be winter. Because if you try and get out in winter, it's going to be a disaster. And you're going to have to pray because there's going to be violent anarchy going on around you. So you run, and you run fast. Jesus describes stomach-churning horror for the city. And the prediction came true. Terrible things were done by people to people. Sadly, it's so common in history, isn't it? Every society, in every time and place, has seen people abusing people, people killing people. Often, those doing it will just look upon their victims as not really counting as human. They're not people like me. They're lesser people. So there's pride and there's arrogance as part of the whole situation. You know, if I asked you some of the ways or some of the reasons people have done this, look down on others and then abuse them. Sometimes they've done it over sex, men against women or whatever. Sometimes they've done it over race. You're from a different place. You're of a different colour. Sometimes they've done it over ability. Well, you can't keep up with the rest of us. You don't really count like us. Sometimes they've done it over tribe. You're from the wrong tribe. Each society, each place, writing off some people, saying they don't count and we can abuse them and we can kill them and it doesn't matter. And it happened there at Jerusalem. The modern West still does it. You know, we think ourselves so proud of how tolerant we are to everybody and everything. And of course we're not. But especially, you think about how we simply write off the unborn. Because they're not worthy of life. They don't count like the rest of us. They're only potential human beings. Every society has done the same. Found its groups that don't count. Not worthy of being treated equally. Their lives aren't like other lives. It's the shameful history of our race. Our collective hands covered in blood. That was the Mark 13 disaster. It was a terrible, blood-filled mess of death. But then, second point, verse 19, let's think about Jesus' words. Those will be days of distress unequaled from the beginning, when God created the world, until now, and never to be equaled again. Now, it could genuinely be hyperbole. There is hyperbole in the Bible, exaggeration to make a point. And it might be safe to assume Jesus is using exaggeration. After all, we know from elsewhere, the Lord Jesus believes in Genesis, and he believes that there was once a great flood that nearly killed the entire human race, the destruction of a whole civilization. Well, does he actually think Jerusalem compares with that? I mean, Jewish culture, Jewish society would continue. It would be radically changed, but it would continue. It wasn't like the annihilation of the horrors of the flood. So we might think, well, I mean, Jesus is conscious of that. I'm sure he's using it in that way just to make his point. And of course, as people who have lived since Jesus, we're inclined to think he's exaggerating because we know of wide-scale horrors that have surely transcended the suffering of Jerusalem. The murders of the 20th century dictators, Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Zedong, millions of people tortured, killed in sick ways, with horrendous suffering, wiping out entire cultures, shudderingly nasty nightmares. So maybe when Jesus describes Jerusalem as the worst of all distresses, he is using hyperbole. You even wonder maybe a little bit, is he wrong to use it? I mean, is it a bit thoughtless to use such language, even if you are trying to make a point, to say it's the worst distress of all time? And yet, comparing suffering is not simple, is it? How do you compare the suffering of different disasters? Do you just count numbers? Is it about the number of people affected? Is that how one should assess what's a worse disaster? Or do you think it ought to be on level of pain? Is it far worse if a lower number of people have horrible, agonising, slow deaths than a larger number of people suddenly are killed without the long-term suffering? Is it worse, the small group or the smaller group? Or is there the factor of age? Is it worse if a disaster strikes a lot who are young as opposed to those who are elderly, because those who are elderly have had their life, they have been able to live, they've been able to enjoy good things, and for them to be suddenly struck down isn't as bad as somebody who's barely started, who's only had a couple of years. Do you assess suffering by age? Or does it have to be the nature of the crime? You know, was Hitler worse than Mao Zedong? Because Hitler aimed to annihilate millions of people on purpose, whereas the latter probably killed more people, but did so because he had these crazy policies about how to run the farms and stuff in a large country, which went disastrously wrong. How do you compare human suffering? How do you decide which suffering is worst? How do you work it out? Even on the individual level, we find it difficult. You can hear a parent say they would suffer greatly to save their child from pain. One outweighs the other. So could Jerusalem's suffering actually be the worst distress? And I think there is a way in which the answer is yes. That Jesus may not just be exaggerating, he may be making a far more important point. Because what happened to that city at the human level was part of something deeper. In that city was a temple, and that temple was described by Jesus as the home, the house of God, a place on earth to find God. Its destruction was the indication that God had left home, had rejected the city because of the terrible sins it had done. And God's departure to lose God actually is the most awful thing of all. Because if you lose God, you lose everything about life. Because God is life. Lose Him, you've lost everything. If He rejects you, you have nothing good left. Now, we never reach that point in this world. God is often kind to us despite how much we've abused Him and abused other people. For all its suffering, earth is never hell. In our times of suffering, we often meet goodness. Even a prisoner in the worst concentration camp may know the care and love of a fellow prisoner. But when God leaves you, when He completely leaves you to yourself, you lose everything. Now, I don't know how much the Jewish folk felt that when Jerusalem was failing, but through Jesus' eyes, it does actually look like hell on earth. What happens if you despise God? You know, at times, when people talk about hell, you know, we bandy the word around, don't we, this place. At times, when people picture hell, they picture it like a torture chamber. They sort of think of it as somewhere God goes to inflict suffering on people who wouldn't do what He said, and He does it at a level which even the worst evil human being can't attain to. It becomes like a torture chamber. And maybe they sort of let God off the hook by handing it over to demons or something and saying, well, they do the torturing. Hell is not God's torture chamber. It's what you get if God finally leaves you completely to yourself. It gets described in the Bible as eternal death. There's just nothing of life left. Hell is not God hurting people who otherwise would be happy, but God's there making them unhappy. Hell is the place where happiness is just gone. It's darkness, it's ruin at the end of the road, where the people run away from God to fall off the cliff. And all the way down the road, God is calling to people and saying, don't run there. But they do. He did that with Jerusalem. He pleaded with Jerusalem to listen. He sent His Son into the middle of Jerusalem to plead with people. And they killed Him for it. All the way down the road, God pleaded with them until they fell off the cliff at the end of the road. No way back. Jerusalem, the fall of Jerusalem, is in a sense the worst distress of all history, because it's the clearest sign in history of what you get if you won't have God. And He leaves you to yourself. But lastly, that brings us to point number three and Jesus' positive statement in the middle of this description of misery. Verse 10. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. The word gospel means news, which is good. It was a general term in Greek. You could use it to announce that a new emperor had just ascended to the Roman Empire or whatever. But here it's being used of the particular good news that has come through Jesus Christ. Hope in despair, life in suffering. The news is this, that there is a way to be saved from the suffering we bring on ourselves. There is a way off the road. And it doesn't mean running off the cliff at the end. There is a way off the road that goes into hell and onto a road that leads to life. The good news is why Jesus doesn't start Mark 13 by saying to His friends, I tell you what, let me save you time, hurt and pain. Let's all leave Jerusalem now. Come on, you, me, let's all go. It's not worth it. It's not worth hanging around here. Let's get out. Jesus does the very opposite. He says to his friends, it's going to be really horrible here. So what I want you to do is hang on as long as possible. And you're going to get really badly treated and it's going to be really dark and nasty. So what I need you to do is hang on as long as possible. Why would he say that? Why would he cause his friends such pain? So that they could tell the good news and show it with their lives that there is a way off this road that leads to hell. That God through them would hold out his hands and say to the city, be saved. Don't be lost. And so Jesus says to his friends, and that good news, it will survive all this disaster. It won't be lost in the crumbling of the temple. It won't be crushed in the smashing of the city. It's going to go out to all the nations, my friends. The way to be saved. In the suffering that you pass through, in the pain, the hurt, the dark places, there's always a voice calling to you. God calls and says, be saved. Just as there was a voice in the darkness of Jerusalem, nearly up to the moment when it fell, saying, be saved. So there is that voice to you. The pain of our lives, the pain of our world, they are pointers to what we've caused. And they're pointers to where it leads. Our sin and our rebellion against God is what has made this world be such a damaged place. The suffering, direct suffering, indirect suffering, it's present not because God doesn't care, that God doesn't love, but because we have constantly rejected God, because we hold on this road. But there is a voice of love crying out, don't carry on down the road. Don't be lost at the end. Come off. Be saved. The pain and the suffering that we pass through, it has other purposes too, but one of the purposes is this, that we would understand what it's like to live without God in a small way. That we would gain, but that we would never fall into the place where we have to live without him completely. And if we will confess our sin and admit our wrong and our failure to know and love God who made us, he's only too ready to welcome us back. In the midst of all the dark places of life, there is a call of good news, a voice of God, and it calls to you now. Be saved, says the voice. Be saved. In verse 13, Jesus says to his friends, people are going to turn on you. People are going to hurt you. Many will not like you telling them about me. But keep doing it. Be that voice in the suffering, he says. It's an extraordinary statement. I mean, you know, you think, is he insane? No. But he's making his friends suffer. He's keeping them in a place that's falling apart. Why would you do that? Because he would have that voice of God calling in the midst of the suffering. That the suffering would actually in the end be used for good purpose. That it would be the way in which people are woken up to be saved. You know, suffering can have good purpose. We know that in various ways, don't we? We know, for example, an operation or whatever, although it hurts, can do us good. But God can even use the suffering. We can never imagine how it could turn to good purpose. But he can turn it to good purpose. He did do in the Jesus' own suffering and death to save his people. Pain, hurt, disaster, catastrophe, death are not good in themselves. They're horrible, but God can use them and work through them. So God is not indifferent to suffering, and he is not unloving. Through these things, he aims to bring good to those who will hear the voice calling to them and will put their faith in his Son to save them. Trust in God this evening. Place your faith in him. Be saved.